from News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
In 2010, Kanikama was elected as the first woman to serve as the GOP assembly leader in almost 30 years. And while Republicans are outnumbered almost 2-1 by Democrats in the state assembly, she has nevertheless kept assembly Republicans relevant in the legislative process by challenging assumptions of the majority party and from time to time finding common ground with Democratic Governor Jerry Brown on restraining state spending by, as she has said, helping the governor, quote, channel his inner Republican, unquote. As she leaves the assembly due to term limits, we sit down and ask her about her thoughts on the legislative process, the challenges facing California, and the future of the California Republican Party. California Retrospective, a conversation with Assembly Minority Leader Connie Conway.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From the California Channel at the State Capitol, Valley PBS, and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Having been a county supervisor and president of the California State Association of Counties, or CSAC, prior to joining the legislature, our guest, Connie Conway, the Assembly Minority Leader, has a unique position to discuss the changing relationship between state and local governments. We're delighted to have her back on the Maddie Report.
Thanks.
Welcome.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, you know, let's start a little bit with how you got involved in politics. You started a little later than most politicians.
I started a lot later than most politicians.
Why?
Well, it wasn't something that I ever studied or thought about, but actually I think what drove me to politics was my father. After a full career with the phone company, he was ready to retire. There was an opening on the Tulare County Board of Supervisors, so he ran and was successful. Unfortunately, in the middle of his third term, at the very young age of 65, we lost him to cancer. So it was 10 years after that, and folks just said, hey, you know, the other guy's going to run. We're not sure how we feel about him. And then part of my life is guilt. They said, you can't let him have your father's seat.
It's in your blood.
Well, and I was almost a reluctant candidate. I think I filed on the last day at the last minute. But
Well, let me ask you this. So you were on the Board of Supervisors for a period of time, and then you became president of CSAC, which represents 58 counties in California. Do you think that helped prepare you for your eventual election to the legislature in 2008?
Oh, definitely. And I think it was really one of the reasons why I ended up doing it. You know, I love the Board of Supervisors. They say all politics is local, but local really is great. I mean, you have direct contact with your constituents. The issues are there. There's five of you, and a decision has to be made. It's not a lot of hearings and committees. It's just like, okay, guys, even when the vote's 3-2, the three will out, and we move forward, and we get something done for our constituents. So I love that, but it was actually, that was part of it, because what I saw in the chairs, going through the chairs at CSAC and then being president, was, I call it the intimate relationship between state and, in particular, county government, and what a mess it was, because the state is very free to mandate programs, and you will do this, throw it down on the counties, and then say, oh, by the way, we're not paying for it.
Yeah, the unfunded mandate.
That's right, exactly.
So you then move into the legislature, and within 2 years, you're named head of the Republicans. So you're now the Assembly Minority Leader. What do you see as your, and you've held that position longer than anyone in the term limits era, which is pretty amazing. So what do you see as your key role as the Assembly Minority Leader?
Well, you know, when I first became Minority Leader, one of the reporters said to me, how does it feel to be the leader of the irrelevant caucus? And I said, I have a sense of humor, sort of. But I said to him, you know, look, I'm not irrelevant to the people that sent me here, and I'm not irrelevant to my one and only special interest group, and that's the taxpayers in California. So you can call us whatever we want, but, you know, I see my role as a voice, not only for my constituents, but for Californians that, as I always say, all honor, praise, and glory to the taxpayers. They get up every day, they go to work, they pay their taxes, they take care of their family, they worship at their place of choice, they give to charity, they volunteer, and they don't have a lot of time for political spin. I think that's why most people are kind of arm's length to it, and I'd like to bring people closer to that, make sure I'm representing the views of average Joe.
Well, talking about taxpayers, we've got this new rainy day fund that they want to change. What are your thoughts about this rainy day fund proposal?
It's been out there for a long time. We kept putting it off. So a rainy day fund proposal, obviously something that Republicans or even conservative Democrats have been, you know, asking for a long time. And I think the compromise that we've reached, the initiative that was going to be on the ballot, we just all voted for that. I mean, the piece of legislation, just to have something. But now we've kind of worked together. I'm not saying nothing's perfect, but this is better. And actually, we fought long and hard as Republicans to get some key pieces in there. We didn't want it to be so easily to sweep it. Oh, we've got a rainy day fund. Oh, but if it's an emergency, we can take it. So we think the terms that we negotiated are pretty good. And God bless the governor. I think he was there for it. So we're good with it.
You know, it seems every time we talk about the state budget, one of the issues that always comes up is the volatility of revenue. So I'm not going to get into the our tax is too high or too low debate, but rather how the state gets revenue. Should we be thinking of other sources that are more stable? And if so, what are they?
That's always a discussion, and in fact, I had the same conversation with Governor Brown when he first got here. We need more revenue, Connie. We need more revenue. And I said, you know, I think what we need, first of all, is to tell people the truth about what the actual revenue is and what we're doing with it. I think that would be important. But secondly, if I were to agree that we need more revenue, here's where we kind of differ in opinion. You know, there's on your side, Governor, you'd like the people that are paying to pay more. We just want to create more taxpayers. If you really need revenue, let's let people work. Let's get off the back of business, free up some of the regulation. I think we're pretty safe now. I think we've maybe overstepped, but let's let people get back to work, and they will gladly do that. I really believe most people want to be part of the community. They just want to work.
We're talking with State Assembly Member Connie Conway, the first woman to serve as GOP Assembly Leader since 1981. Well, every year the legislature seems like they're dealing with hundreds of bills. Should there be a limit in the number of bills that the legislature considers in one year?
Oh, you're singing my song. Yes. I mean, I know there's been movements for part-time legislature. You know, my thought on that is even one day a year, we can put 2,500 really bad bills on a consent calendar and pass them. So I really like the idea of limiting the bills, not in a punishment sort of way. I think that because there's so many, I mean, there's 120 of us. Everybody gets 40 plus committees. Plus, if you're large and in charge, you can do whatever you want. And it's an expectation. You can run up to 40. I think they just hear 40. In my mind, if we limited that, maybe we could really focus. You know, because oftentimes there's probably 10 bills that are exactly the same. There's no coordination. People put them across the desk. It costs between $10,000 and $20,000, I've heard, just to get a bill across the desk. Smaller amounts of legislation, but more focused on the big issues that are important to people. And the legislators should be spending more time not only talking to their constituents, but to each other. We should be solving the problems of education, of budget, whatever it is, in a more thorough way.
It might be that the glory of being able to have a bill passed is it captures legislators sometimes. What about putting sunset provisions on laws? You know, trying them out for a while, seeing if they work, and, you know, either changing them, modifying them, or removing them.
You know, I think that's just another tool that would be a good idea. I think what I found, I did have a couple of bills that ended up being pilots, one out in Inyo County that I represent, but it's going to, the pilot's going to expire probably before we even get it started. But there's got to be middle ground where you could figure those things out, and I think it makes sense because most constituents say for every bill you pass, take two away. So sunsetting
it's like
would
closing
be,
your closet.
It would be a great idea.
So what, you've been in the legislature for a while. What bills are you most proud of?
Well, as leader, I've tried actually not to have a huge bill package, rather work with our policy people and help our members find areas of expertise or bills that they want to run. But I think some of the education pieces have been really important to me. I feel like jobs in the economy is number one in every poll when you ask people what's important. And for me, education, jobs in the economy are chicken and egg stuff. You know, what's first? Do you have a good economy that's creating jobs but not an educated workforce? Or do you, you know, pump up the educated workforce and then there's no job to go to? So education's really been a favorite of mine.
You know, that's interesting. When you start looking at the research, what employers typically say is one of the biggest problems is having the right worker for the job that they have. And so having that skilled workforce is really critical for employment.
Yeah.
You know, loss of unintended consequences, Nobody bats 1,000. So are there any laws that you've been involved with that passed that you're thinking in retrospect, maybe not so much?
My own, maybe one or two. And I thought I was working with, you know, the right people to make it happen. And it did. And then I was able the next year to come back and kind of revise my own bill. And that was on, that was who needed to be fingerprinted to be a volunteer at a high school in a coaching situation. And I guess inadvertently it included parents that wanted to volunteer as band volunteers, but in retrospect, it wasn't that bad. I mean, it nowadays, can you be too safe with your children at school? So, but we did come back, modify it a little bit. Sometimes in voting, it's, you know, it's a really a worry to someone like me. I mean, I want to make sure if I'm putting my stamp of approval on something that I really understand it, but sometimes, and purposely so, I think, they make it so difficult for us to see. And then it's just like with the budget, I would say, there's a poison pill in there. And so there's two really good pieces of this trailer bill. And then what the heck is this? You know, it's almost like it's purposely done to challenge us.
Well, it's kind of, you know, you want perfect to be the enemy of the good. So
right,
you know, maybe
right.
You move two steps forward and one step back, but you still move one step forward. What about supermajority rules? You know, you hear a lot about that. Where some people say, listen, you're letting a small minority control the majority. We're a democracy. After all.
Yeah.
Others say, no, you need that as a necessary check on majority overreach. What are your thoughts on supermajority votes and rules?
I think, you know, balance in anything. I mean, we hear this all the time. We need life balance. We need nutritional balance. Well, we need legislative balance, I would say. I can't remember. What's the famous quote? Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been very interesting in this supermajority, superminority world. While my friends across the aisle would say, look how good we've been. We've been the supermajority, and we did not do split roll on Prop 13, and we didn't do all these evils. Well, truth be told, they really didn't have a supermajority until January of this year because of he's running for this, she's over there. So while on paper they had it, they didn't have people in the chair. So when we came back into session in January, finally the supermajority existed. And then I got a little help from the FBI in the Senate. So there's still this mythological supermajority doesn't really exist. But certainly there's enough votes there to dominate any type of legislation that we have.
Let me ask you this. We've got a minute left in the segment. I want to ask you about the whole thing of compromise. It seems like it used to be politics was the art of compromise. Now it's compromise is a dirty word. You know, Eric Cantor recently had an experience with that.
Yes.
I mean, what are your thoughts about that? Should legislators be looking over their shoulders for fear if they compromise on something, they're going to get voted out of office?
I think there's always fringe groups that want to control, whether that's far right or far left, you know, and the rest of us that are in the middle are just kind of really. But I'm very hopeful. Of course, I'm always cautiously optimistic, that the extended term limits, even though it's a shorter time, it's extended, will help with that. I think back in the day, compromise was easier because exactly that. I mean, I'm one of those babies that had 6 years in the assembly. So you get here, you feel like you have to do something. You're constantly running for election and you're always worried. I'm hopeful with extended term limits, people have more time to actually kick back, work with each other, and make really good decisions.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to talk about how to improve legislative responsiveness and also root out political corruption. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking with Connie Conway, a Republican from Tulare and the longest-serving Assembly Republican leader in the term limits era. So people often complain about corrupt politicians, and we've got some recent happenings in the state Senate that are giving them too many examples, frankly. Are some people just inherently greedy, or is there something about politics that invites corruption?
You know, I think a lot of people believe that the influence of special interest groups would, you know, lends itself to this unholy alliance between politics and perceived corruption or maybe real corruption. And it's something I've given a lot of thought to. I think if you have basic values, then you won't let yourself get drawn into that. But you do get comfortable in any situation. I think sometimes when people get too comfortable, they are more susceptible to maybe thoughts and suggestions that aren't that holy.
Shifting ethics or situational ethics.
Yeah.
You know, if it is kind of a personal thing, the failings of a few bad apples. Is there anything we can do to stop it?
You know, I think the more transparent we are, the better. And I know, but it's always, it scares me on the other hand that the legislature sees a problem, real or perceived, and then they want to legislate it. So you're going to see lots of transparency bills. I know the Senate has just voted to forbid themselves from having contact with or fundraisers at given times of the year. But, you know, part of me just believes, you know, if you're going to do that, you're going to do that. But if it looks better to people, if it makes it more transparent process, I'm okay with it. I'm really okay with whatever makes sense. If you're right with yourself and you're an ethical person, then who cares?
So transparency might be a good thing.
I think. I'm for transparency in everything.
Let me transition a little bit and talk about just the size of the legislature. I don't think a lot of people understand that the California legislature has been the same size since 1879. The state has 40 times the population since then. And if you take a look at California legislators and you compare them to New York and Illinois legislators, you represent three times as many constituents. So it's a little counterintuitive, but should we be thinking about enlarging the California legislature?
Oh, my gosh. I wonder how the general public would feel about that.
I'm not sure it would poll well, but
yeah, they think there's too many of us anyway. As long as the volume of work is met, for me, it the most interesting thing about that amount of constituents, they try to balance it. But for me, I used to have 36,000 square miles, and if you're in downtown L.A., it's probably 4 square miles, you know. But the amount of folks that you represent would be the same. My real thoughts on that are, if it seems like there's too many of us, I think it's because the subject we talked about before, too many bills. If we had less legislation, I don't think it would feel like it's that big, and maybe it would even leave space to have more legislators.
Now, here's a counterargument. What about if we put the two houses together and had a unicameral legislature? I mean, at the federal level, we have, you know, representation by states in the Senate and then by population in the House. But in California, both the Senate and the Assembly are both by population. Isn't that redundant?
In some ways, it seems redundant, and I've had mixed emotions about that prior to coming here and now that I'm here. If anything, having the two houses, it kind of provides a check and balance, because for me, I have to get a bill out of a committee, I have to get it through appropriations, and I have to get it to the floor, and then maybe the Assembly votes on it, and then it goes over to the Senate, and it has to go through the same process over there. Now, some people say, yeah, that's just an excuse to kill things. But I'd like to err on the side of caution, so maybe it's good that we hear it, we go through the process, refine it, then it has to go through another process in the other house, and sometimes that's where good amendments happen, mm-hmm. you know, in order to get it over there. So you rehear it and you see it. You'd like to think that if it passes out of both houses and it's been that thoroughly examined, that it would be thoroughly vetted. And yet the governor's job is to get rid of half of that stuff. So I don't know if I argued against myself there. I'm not sure.
Okay. It's recently been reported that if current trends continue, by 2024, registered Republicans will drop to third behind Democrats and decline to state in California. What does our guest, Assembly Minority Leader Connie Conway, think is the way back for the California Republican Party? So what does the California Party have to do to reverse these trends?
You know, it's a question that we've asked ourselves for a few years, but in the past couple of years, we've really had we're on a mission, if you will, to speak for ourselves and define ourselves. And, you know, what does a party look like? What does it mean to be a Republican? You know, it's easy for others to define us. I've always felt I would like to define myself. And I think we have a new party chairman. Not to speak disparagingly of other chairmen, they were all fine and did what they did. Jim Brulte, our new chairman. It's very interesting as we do many, many things together, Senate Leader Huff, myself, and Mr. Brulte. You know, he used to have my job. Mm-hmm. He used to have Huff's job. And he's a larger-than-life character. So I really enjoy that. He leaves policy to us. And we're really trying to take the party in the direction that we think it's always been, but maybe we didn't articulate. Very inclusive. My candidates, I'm so proud of them. Even one of our candidates from our Fresno area, you know, we have a diverse group. We have a lot of women running. We have ethnic diversity in our candidates. And that's really the heart of the party. It's just our business to make sure people understand.
Well, what about a schism or a difference of opinion between the social conservatives and the fiscal conservatives? Can the Republican Party be both? Do they have to pick one?
I'm the kind of person that believes we don't have to pick one, but there's others that think we should. And if that happens, okay. I'm just a person that believes that we should talk about the basic values and issues that are important to people. And the social issues, look, I have my own personal beliefs. I'm not sure I want to lead with that if I'm in a political conversation. That those are very personal issues to me. But if you're talking about moving California forward economically, I'm not sure that we should spend majority of our time talking about social issues.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the California Republican Party currently too conservative or not conservative enough?
Half of the party would say we're too conservative. And honestly, I think it's really a half and half. I see it in my caucus every day. And the other half would say, you know, we're too moderate, or if I missed one of those, anyway, half and half. And it is a dilemma, and it is a caution. I always tell people I'm looking for reasonable, sensible adults that can have an adult conversation and agree to disagree, but still make progress forward. But that doesn't work for everybody. So the party is at a real crux. I mean, I think Senator Brulte stepped in at a time when we needed a different type of leadership, and he's filling that role for the future. Obviously, it remains to be seen. If it takes a complete schism, then it will happen.
You know, one of the things that's been talked about is voter fraud. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's been talked about is voter apathy. What's the bigger problem? And how do we address either or both?
You know, voter fraud, and I hear a lot about that from both sides of the aisle. I like to refer to it as voter integrity. The people that have the right to vote should be given that opportunity to do that. There are some in our society that don't have that opportunity. I think it's been forefront with the last couple of elections, but I really believe there were two things that added to that. First, it was redistricting, redrawing the lines, and so people would go to the wrong polling place, and they didn't know where they lived. And then with an open primary, it causes a lot of confusion. I guess I always want to believe that people are inherently want to do the right thing. There's always bad actors. We've just tried really hard to monitor the voting situation and make sure that it's all equal.
Well, let me ask this. Going to voter apathy. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that for a second. I mean, you know, a woman elected to Assembly Minority Leader, the Republican Party, do you think it's going to attract more women into politics?
I would hope so. It's interesting. We do look at these statistics if you're talking about women in politics. When I first got here, there, you know, obviously about 20%, I think, of our caucus were women, and probably 28% on the Dem side. That has gone down, actually. We are smaller in the Republican Party, but we have a bigger plurality of women than the Democrats do. They lost a lot of women in the last election. And so I think that speaks well for our party. And our diversity, actually is increasing too. So it's always a question. Look, women are 50% of the world. I always feel like they should have their fair share of representation.
I know some people would agree with you. So listen, we got 1 minute left in the segment, and yes. I wanted to get this question in, and that is, if you were giving advice to young women or men who want to get involved in the legislative process, go into politics, what advice would you give them?
Well, I mean, one of my standard pieces of advice is don't fear change, because sometimes fear holds you back from making good decisions. But specifically to politics, you know, I know for me it wasn't something I studied or thought about. I find young Californians a lot more politically interested than I think maybe they were at one time. But I would tell them, be open to conversation, do your homework, get your facts straight, and try to make the best learned decision that you can before you get involved or take a position on anything.
That's fantastic advice. Well, I want to thank Assembly Minority Leader Connie Conway for joining us.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Daryl Steinberg has been leader of the California State Senate since 2008, and the first Senate leader from Sacramento since 1883. During his tenure, he's had to grapple with deep program cuts to deal with the multi-billion-dollar deficits that the state has faced and the demands for the restoration of those cuts as the state's fortunes have improved. As he approaches the end of his term as Senate Pro Tem in October, we'll ask him to look back on his leadership and what he thinks needs to be done to make government generally and the legislature specifically more responsive in addressing both the everyday needs and future aspirations of the largest state in the nation. California Retrospective,
a conversation with Senate Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, leader of the California Senate.
From the California Channel at the State Capitol, Valley PBS, and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
We're coming to you today from the Senate Democratic Caucus studio at the State Capitol. Our guest is Senate Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, who will be ending his tenure as leader of the California State Senate on October 15th, after 6 years due to term limits. We're delighted to have him join us to talk about some of the successes and challenges he's had over his tenure, as well as his perspective on the role of the California legislature in shaping California public policy. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Good to be with you, Mark.
Well, first, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your background? How and why did you get involved in politics?
Well, I grew up in the Bay Area. I grew up in a middle-class community. I like to say I graduated high school the year before Prop 13 passed. And what that means to me is that even though I grew up in a middle-class community, there was always after-school sports and the rec center and the library was always open. And I never had time to get in trouble even if I wanted to. And I had a very rich childhood in terms of experience. And I was motivated from a young age, really, to think about trying to do something in life that would help other people, and was drawn to the law and to law school. And I went to UC Davis Law School after graduating from UCLA. After UC Davis, I got my first job in Sacramento, and the job didn't last long, but I got involved in the community and the Jewish community and the Human Rights Commission. I started a neighborhood association. And then in 1992, the incumbent council member called me the night before the filing deadline for her reelection and said, "I'm not running for reelection." The night before, 10:30 at night.
Late notice.
So I can literally say I decided to run for office overnight. And I did, and it's been 20 years of active service within those 22 years, and it's been great.
Well, let me ask you this. What is your proudest legislative accomplishment?
I think there are three things, but or maybe four, but I think the thing that I'm most proud of is that my work has led to over $1.5 billion worth of continuing investment into California's mental health system. This is an issue near and dear to my heart, both personally and otherwise, and I feel very strongly that it's one of the under-attended to issues of our time, and that the failure to deal with mental health and mental illness causes many other societal problems that we spend a lot of money on and that cause a lot of heartache, whether it's homelessness, criminal justice, family dysfunction, child welfare. And we've made a real difference in building a public system and literally helped tens of thousands of people.
I was doing a little research, and I think the number is $8 billion has
been raised. Well, cumulatively, Prop 63, the Mental Health Services Act, generates about $1.3 billion this year. Mm-hmm. In addition to some of the legislative work over the last couple of years, where we've invested hundreds of millions in crisis beds and triage workers, and this year $100 million or so in connecting mental health services and the criminal justice system. Done a lot, but the more I do, the more I realize how much unmet need is.
The need never goes away. What about education? You know, recently you were a big proponent for creating universal pre-K in California.
Yeah.
Why is that issue so important? And what do you say to those folks who say, well, the process really doesn't work, or it's too expensive?
Well, I've had a couple of major focuses when it comes to public education, and early childhood education is one of them. But I think the thing I'm most proud of is in this year's budget, for the second year in a row, we are gaining another $250 million to re-engineer and change California's high schools to build career pathways for high school students. We can no longer afford to have a system that's either focused on high academic standards or vocational education. We need to combine the two so that every student's got a pathway to a high-wage job. And there's tremendous excitement out there. I'm very proud of that. In addition, this year—
Will that money be going to community colleges? Where will that money be going?
We are, the first round of money, the first $250 million, we had over $700 million worth of applications. And they're generally collaborations between high schools and high school districts, community colleges, and Lead California Industries that work together to say that at age 15 or 16, it's not too early for young people to begin to understand the relationship between this, quote, boring subject that they're being forced to learn as part of their graduation requirement and what it might mean for their future and their job interests. So we're combining career application and academics by bringing in industry, collaborating with high schools and with school districts and with community colleges to create soup to nuts so that a 15 or 16 year old can not only have curriculum that's taught in a way that's much more interesting and applied, internships, summer jobs, ultimately post-secondary assistance either for apprenticeship or college, and then a job in the industry itself.
Let me ask you this. We've only got about 30 seconds left, so this is going to be not a lot of time, but have you ever passed a law that in retrospect you might have regretted? Any do-overs?
I've authored a number of bills where I landed on my butt, where I did not succeed. I took on sales tax sharing in 2001 and 2002 and lost. But then it led to my effort around regional planning and SB 375, which has now changed the planning landscape in California. Smart growth is now the norm. And my failure in not getting sales tax sharing created enough controversy, but also interest, that it led to an ultimate success. I have one or two more examples of that.
We're talking with the leader of the California's upper house, Senate Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg. Well, let's talk about the legislative process for a moment. Governor Brown has stated not every problem needs a solution. So do you think the state legislature maybe passes too many laws?
I understand the criticism, and there may be some truth to it. But look, here's the nature of the process. There's 120 legislators. They all represent districts. They all have strong opinions. And even though there are a lot of bills, the process actually works pretty well because the process works as a funnel. And a bill that is introduced, if it gets through the whole process, is not necessarily the bill that is the end product. It has to go through numerous committees, it gets refined, it gets amended, it gets changed, it gets defeated. A number of bills get defeated. And what ends up on the governor's desk, by and large, is the reflection of 9 months of work. And more often than not, the bills address significant and important public policy issues.
Well, let me ask you this. What's the survival rate? If I'm a legislator and I present a bill, what's the chance of that thing getting signed into law?
Well, the chances are probably about 50-50 that some version of the bill will get signed into law. The chances are virtually nil that the bill as introduced will make it to the governor as it was introduced. And that's the way it should be.
It's the starting of the negotiating process.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you about supermajority rules, where you have to have a two-thirds majority to do things. Some argue that that gives way too much power to the minority at the expense of the majority. Others say, no, you need this to prevent majority overreach. What are your thoughts on supermajority
rules? Oh, I have a very strong opinion here. The most important thing that the California voters have done over the past 25 years is to pass Proposition 25, which allows now for a majority vote budget. It's not that the point of view of the minority party is not important. It is. And in an ironic way, since Prop 25 passed, I think there's been more bipartisanship and nonpartisanship,
Why?
At least in the Senate, because there isn't that age-old opportunity to leverage every major decision. Why did we have interminably late summer budgets year after year after year? People say, well, the legislature couldn't get its act together, state government wasn't working. I don't think that's true. Number one, we face some of the most catastrophic financial times and economic times in recent history. When I started as pro tem, we had a $42 billion deficit. You ask me what my great source of pride is in terms of my tenure over 6 years, beyond any legislative accomplishment, is that I'm the last one standing from that era, and I'm leaving California and the legislature better off than when I started, and the state's in much better shape. We got surpluses, reserves, and we're beginning to restore some of the cuts. But the point is that there isn't that opportunity to hold up the budget based upon narrow interests, the budget gets done on time. Fourth year in a row, an on-time budget. That's good for California.
So propositions are good. Does there need to be any modification of the initiative or proposition process?
I actually have a big bill on that in my final months in the legislature. I want to bring back what's called the indirect initiative. What does that mean? Right now, an initiative proponent has to submit signatures generally in February, March, or April of an election year. Once those signatures are submitted, it takes a long time for the counties and ultimately for the Secretary of State to certify the measure, but there's no turning back. In other words, if there's a negotiation in those intervening months, the initiative proponent has to follow through. Now, they don't have to campaign.
But there have been situations like that where it stays on the ballot where
absolutely.
It's already been resolved.
My measure would say that up until the time the Secretary of State is actually ready to publish the ballot pamphlet and put the election ballot together, mm-hmm. an initiative proponent can withdraw the initiative if they choose. No pressure. But if there is, in fact, a legislative solution to the problem, they can withdraw. That'll be a dramatic improvement to the initiative process.
So what about the role of the legislature in an oversight of the executive branch? So you pass a law, and the executive branch administers it. You want to make sure it's being administered the way you intended. Is there anything that should be done or could be done to improve the oversight process?
Absolutely. I think one of the other things the voters of California did recently was change term limits so that now a member can serve 12 years in any one house. I serve under an era where it's 6 years in the Assembly, 8 years in the Senate. I'm lucky I've had 14. But let me tell you what the 12 years in one house will mean. It will mean that members don't have to be so anxious about putting their name on a bill or authoring a bill. Instead, more time can be spent on oversight, which is, I think, a lost art in the legislature. There have been some signature examples of good oversight, whether it was the Quackenbush investigation, whether it's the Senate office we have to conduct oversight on a systemic and ongoing basis. But by and large, there's not an incentive in the term limit era for members to spend that time on oversight. I think the change in term limits is going to create more opportunity for oversight. That's very important.
Okay, well, legislative oversight also includes dealing with the bad actors in the legislature. How to deal with ethical lapses in a way that restores public confidence in the legislature? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. As the California State Senate pro tem, Daryl Steinberg is not just the leader of his party, he's the custodian of the institution's integrity. Well, while you've been described as squeaky clean, you have presided over a Senate where you have two members that have been indicted for federal corruption charges and a third that's been convicted of perjury. You've said, quote, "I know of no ethics class that teaches about the illegality or the danger of gun running or other such sordid activities," unquote. So if these are just the personal failings of a few bad apples, what, if anything, can be done about this problem?
Well, I have been of two very clear minds on this subject, and no one could have anticipated this. I certainly didn't anticipate it, and it's certainly not in the pro tem leadership manual how to deal with these things. But I've said two things. Number one, the actions of a few, the alleged actions of a few, do not reflect the behavior, the ethics of the vast majority of members. The people I have the pleasure to lead and serve with are hardworking people who put the public's interests first. Having said that, I think that what's happened in the Senate this year does give us an opportunity and, frankly, an obligation to step back and reflect on what we can all do different. And there's no question that money in politics is a very real phenomenon, especially with the Supreme Court saying that money is speech in unlimited forms. And we have to be very conscious and reinforce a code of ethics that says that you must be willing and able to look your supporter in the eye and tell them, on this one, I'm not with you if it's the right thing to do. Secondly, while we're not going to take money out of politics, we can do some things like what we're doing in the Senate to call for blackout periods where during the major time when we're hearing bills, there is no fundraising. August, the last month of the session, by Senate rule now, we will not be allowed to collect fundraising checks nor solicit checks from lobbyist employers. I think that's a good thing. In addition, we've now put forward an ombudsperson in the Senate to ensure that any member of the staff, member of the public, a member him or herself, who sees an ethical behavior can complain even anonymously.
So what is that?
And there'll be some intervention.
So the ombudsman will work out of whose office?
The ombudsman will work for the Senate itself, okay. But they will have independence.
Okay. So, but if someone brings a complaint to the ombudsman, what power do they have to rectify the situation?
They will have the full authority of the pro tem's office and the Senate Ethics Committee to intervene, and hopefully intervene first in an informal way, to say to the alleged offender or to say to the office, there have been a number of complaints about XYZ, you need to knock it off, or here's what you need to do. Because if you don't, this is going to lead to real trouble. And I think these are the sorts of changes that reinforce the culture that I continue to be proud of in and around this institution that I love, that the vast majority of people are there to do the public's business, and they do it honestly.
You know, LA Times columnist George Skelton was talking about, you know, the cost of running for office, and he noted that it's actually more than this, $1 million to run a state Senate campaign. Is that the problem? Is the root of all evil here money?
Well, I think it's two things. I think money is a real problem. I think there's way too much money. But the public is, frankly, of two minds, because they largely don't support public financing of campaigns. And at the same time, they don't like this system. And the Supreme Court, I think very erroneously, has not been willing to say that it is legitimate to put some limits on political expenditures. As a result, no matter what you try to do to limit contributions, for example, all that does is empower wealthy individuals or outside interests to spend even more money, quote, independently.
Money is disclosure, maybe transparency, the answer?
I think transparency and disclosure are very important, and we're beefing that up as well. But I have to say another thing, and that is that people come to public office, I think, largely with their character pretty much formed. And if you're an honest person, then a lot of what goes on around you won't affect your core or your willingness to make the right decisions. Politics is politics, and sometimes you have to make compromises. Nobody's, you know, absolutely pure here. On the other hand, if you come to the office with a different kind of character, the temptations are there. There is too much money in the darn system. And I think it provides a recipe for trouble for some people.
So the answer is elect honest people, I guess.
Well,
we've been talking with Senate Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg about his tenure as leader of the California Senate. I'd like to take a look forward now at the future of California. I want to talk a little bit about the partisanship that seems to be occurring in state politics. You know, it's interesting where the Senate Democrats meet, just off the floor of the state Senate, is the Ken Matty Lounge. Ken Matty is our namesake. He was a former Republican leader in the 80s and 90s. It seems like a lot has changed since he was in office. What do you think about this increasing partisan divide? Is it just a moment in time, or is this the new normal?
Well, I think, contrasted to what goes on in Washington, D.C., California legislative politics is a lot more bipartisan. We have our arguments and fights, but let me tell you, the Senate, even with some of the challenges we've had this year, is a place where there is civil discourse, and we work well together. And I think if you talk to Bob Huff or anybody on the Republican side, or at least most of them, they would agree with that. And so when I look at Ken Matty, I get to look at his picture every Tuesday here. I didn't have the privilege of knowing him, but I wish I had, because he epitomizes everything that I think is right about politics. And In some small way, if I could live up to his ideal, or if I have lived up to his ideal, then that's a good thing, because I believe that politics is about fighting hard for what you believe in and not being afraid to argue and to fight, but in the right way. Right. And ultimately, as a mediator, I know that what's most important is not only what you stand for, but what you actually get done. Because when it's all said and done, what do I leave with? I'm going to leave with a lot of friendships, a lot of great relationships, and a lot of great memories. But I'm going to leave with a record of accomplishment. And that's only done when you are willing to look at what you want, but then look at what you can get and ask yourself, am I moving a big agenda forward? Child care and preschool this year, great example. I wanted universal preschool. Instead, we're setting a path for universal preschool for all low-income four-year-olds. Is it everything that I wanted? No. Is it a big stride? Absolutely. Does it set the stage for somebody else to then take it to the next level? Yes.
So it's all about moving the ball down the field. I want to ask you about the Republican Party a little bit. I know you're the leader of the Democrats, but Republican Party has been a bit of a decline. And if trends continue, a decline to state, going to outnumber Republicans by 2024 in the state. Is that a good thing for the legislative process? Don't we need a loyal opposition?
I do think we need a strong two-party system. And I will say that even though I am a strong partisan Democrat, what I have seen over the last 2 years, again, since Prop 25 went into effect, since Democrats won their super majorities, I see more Republicans now beginning to get it. I'm seeing more Republicans in the legislature voting for California's versions of immigration reform. I'm seeing more Republicans understand and accept that equality for gays and lesbians represents the majority of where people stand, and it's the right thing to do. I'm seeing Republicans cast votes on things that they never would have touched even 3-4 years ago. Not all of them, but I'm beginning to see a change. And I think, yes, that may create more competition between Democrats and Republicans, but I think that's a good thing.
Well, last question. We've only got a minute left. I want to ask you this. What are the biggest lessons you've learned as a legislator and political leader? And what advice would you give to the next generation of legislators and political leaders?
When you come into the legislature for a limited period of time, it is absolutely essential that you focus on one or two or three things that really matter, and hopefully they're things that nobody else is really paying much attention to, so that you can use your passion, your intellect, your ability to actually move an agenda forward. And finally, I would say, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, when you're in politics, never, never, never give up. Fight in the right way for what you believe in, and you can accomplish great things for people.
Well, I want to thank Senate Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg for being our guest today.
If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.